Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the racingnews365.com Formula One podcast. My name is Balv Baines and I'm joined by Michael Butterworth and Dieter Renken. Michael, so good to have you on this podcast. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Balv. It's great to have you on the first Racing News 365 podcast. So it's nice for me to be on the other side of the microphone for a change.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll both look after me. Dieter, I know you were flying back from Saudi yesterday. How are you?
I'm great. And again, welcome, Balv. Good to see you here. And I'm really looking forward to sort of a three-way discussion about the Saudi Grand Prix. Yes, as you say, I flew in late last night, hence we're only recording today, Tuesday. But a lot has happened in the interim, so that's great stuff.
No, it is great stuff. I'm excited to be here. So thank you both for the warm welcome. Dieter, I want to stay on you, if I may. You were in the paddock. You were at the Jeddah Corniche Racing. So what was the vibe there throughout the weekend whilst you were there?
Well, I think the first thing to stress is that they've actually held three Grand Prix in 16 months, which is a massive achievement for an emerging Grand Prix. And, you know, having been there in 2021, which of course was the penultimate round of the championship, it was very much Max versus Lewis, etc. There was an awful lot of pressure all around, not only on the promoter, but also on the competitors. For the media, it was a new place, etc. Then, of course, last year happened 4 months afterwards. And so from that perspective, again, there'd been these sort of developments within the paddock. But now we've had a full year's break since last year's race. And I must confess, the promoters have really gone out of their way to try and turn this into a really iconic kind of Grand Prix. You know, obviously, we're talking Saudi Arabia. We know about the challenges, so I certainly don't want to dwell on them, but we also can't ignore them. But fundamentally, what they are trying to do is to really get a place on the calendar through a very, very good Formula One standard type Grand Prix.
It did look amazing from an outside perspective watching on TV. Michael, how did it look over in China when you were watching the race from your end?
Well, I must confess I didn't watch it live because this is one of the several races of the year where the time zone doesn't really work for me. But I did get up early on Monday morning and watched it through as live. And yeah, it's one of those that looks amazing under lights. You know, we used to have the Bahrain Grand Prix in the middle of the day and it just looks absolutely transformed when it's at nighttime. And the original plan was they were only going to race here for sort of 2 or 3 years, weren't they? And they were going to have that purpose-built track elsewhere in Saudi. Now it looks as if we're going to be staying at Jeddah for at least the next few years, the foreseeable future. And it really does look like a spectacular facility. There's been tremendous racing in the three races that we've had over the last 16 months. It seems to be a real favourite for the drivers. And it's a real treat to watch on telly.
I spoke to Prince Khalid, who's the president of the Saudi Arabian Motorsport Federation and also one of the prime movers and shakers. And I spoke to him both within a sort of a media huddle and then exclusively afterwards. And, you know, the sort of stuff that he was telling us about how this was originally a sort of an ad hoc street circuit while they were waiting for the real one, if I can call it that, to be built in Qiddiya, and how they've now decided to transform this entire Corniche area. And they do now have it for track days, they do have it for club races, etc. So there you are in the middle of one of Saudi's bigger cities, a metropolis on the Red Sea, and almost slap bang in the middle of this, across the road from the Red Sea Mall, we have the circuit that they're using on a daily basis for track days and all sorts of things. Absolutely remarkable.
My favourite off-the-track activity was the drone show. It looked absolutely incredible. But we're not here to talk about off-the-track. We're here to talk about what happened on the track. Michael, I'm not sure where to start, but P3, let's go with that debacle. It was Alonso's, then it was Russell's. They went back to Alonso. For the listeners here, what happened with that P3 place?
Well, it started with something, well, exactly the same issue that we had with Esteban Ocon in Bahrain. He was adjudged to have started not quite from inside his grid slot. And indeed, that's another issue which I'd like to talk about slightly later. But anyway, he got slapped with this 5-second penalty. It was then decreed afterwards that he hadn't served the 5-second penalty correctly at his pit stop because the rear jack had been touching the rear of the car. So he got slapped with a 10-second time penalty after that. That demoted him to fourth place. Aston Martin then appealed that, saying that there had been other instances where the front jack had touched the car and this was deemed to be okay, so why couldn't it be the rear jack? And then the FIA agreed with Aston Martin's interpretation and put Alonso back into third place. George Russell, for his part, when he was awarded the third place after that initial 10-second penalty, he was very gracious about it, saying that it should have belonged to Alonso. So I think justice was served and it was the right decision. It reflects very badly on the FIA that they could issue this 10-second penalty and then go back on that decision afterwards after having the appeal from Aston Martin. It looks as if the FIA don't really know their own rules.
Could I come in there, Belv, if you don't mind? I think, Michael, you're 100% correct. But I think what we need to do is look here at some of the background stuff. Yes, absolutely. When I say the FIA, it was actually the stewards. And let's not forget they are an independent body. But yeah, they are known as the FIA stewards. But fundamentally, what happened is that the Aston Martin were able to, as part of the right of review process, be able to prove that in the past this had been a sort of accepted modus operandi. It was almost an unwritten agreement, agreed at the Sporting Advisory Committee level, that this was permitted. Therefore, Aston Martin at the time believed that what they had done was within the parameters of what is permitted, even if not within the parameters of the law or the regulations as they stand. What will now happen is that there will be a clarification on this one. But I try and look at it from both perspectives. First of all, I'm questioning why it took the FIA effectively almost 40 laps to decide that we got to investigate this. That should have happened a lot quicker. I'm hearing, and I stress, I'm hearing as opposed to I have definitive proof, that it was in fact Mercedes who alerted the FIA race direction, who in turn spoke to the stewards, because that's a correct process, that they thought that there was something iffy about the pit stop. I also question how and why it was leaked on television first. Did somebody actually call television and say, by the way, I think you better look at this, or alert the authorities to it? The whole thing was pretty messy. Whoever did alert the FIA, be it a team, be it somebody else within the FIA, it actually backfired spectacularly. And that is why this regulation needs to be totally rewritten.
They were actually, Aston Martin was saying that the first they knew of this, that they knew that there might be a penalty coming their way, was by listening to the television broadcast, which seems pretty extraordinary when they were the team that that this whole thing centered on.
Absolutely. And again, here we need to look at the communications internally between television, the FIA, etc. And I find it extraordinary that television should have had the first whisper. And I can only assume that somebody somewhere within Mercedes called, when I say called, a euphemism, but got hold of Sky Television. And we do know that there has been a change of structure within that. And I'm just wondering whether it wasn't somebody who's rather cozy with the Mercedes team.
I think you mentioned there, Dieter, you said pretty messy. I think that's an understatement, if I will. Michael, let's go to you. You mentioned that point of the grid starting slot. Could you give us more insight onto that, please?
Well, so Alonso was initially given the penalty because if you look at the race start again, you can see that his left wheel is outside the grid slot. We've had quite a few of the other drivers, George Russell notably, saying that actually when you're pulling up on the grid, it's very difficult because of so much body work on the car. It's very difficult to see where the wheels line up. Max Verstappen as well saying that... Well, Fernando Alonso didn't really gain any advantage by being over to the left-hand side, even though he ultimately did end up taking the lead at the first corner. But, that probably would have happened had he had all four wheels inside his grid slot. So the penalty that was given to him initially, I felt, didn't really need to be given if there's no clear advantage for Alonso starting slightly to the left of the grid slot.
Perfect. And in other news, McLaren, Dieter, where do we start with them? Their woes continue onto the second race of the season.
They do continue. You're absolutely correct, Belf. But equally, they had touches on the opening lap. Both their cars did. And I think we do need to have a look at the really superb performance on the part of Oscar Piastri. Getting that car into Q3. And then, of course, there was this touch in the opening lap, which was a great, great pity. And thereafter, they just couldn't really recover. But I think if we really want to look at it, the bright side of the Saudi Grand Prix for McLaren is that they were able to get a car into Q3. And equally, Oscar Piastri was able to prove that all the hype last year about him, the contract recognition board stuff, jumping ship from an LP non-contract to McLaren. People were talking about him going to Williams and all sorts of things. I think that ultimately his qualifying performance justified all the Ferrari around him last year. That, yeah, he is an emerging talent, and that McLaren were right to do everything they could to get hold of the guy.
I think if we're looking for green shoots of recovery for McLaren as well, it's worth noting that they both got to the end, which sounds like a pretty low bar for a team of the achievement and calibre and history of McLaren. But they had those problems in Bahrain. Piastri was the first retirement of the season, pulling off after about 15 laps in Bahrain. Lando Norris had that engine issue, which meant that he had to pit four or five times and he finished dead last. And yeah, I agree with Dieter. Oscar Piastri's performance today, getting the McLaren into Q3 for the first time this season, very, very impressive. Obviously, both cars very unlucky to be stymied by those problems on the opening laps that meant they both had to have new front wings, and then that sort of ruined their progress. But we've got such a tight midfield this year that had Piastri managed to keep his P9 that he'd qualified in, I think he would have very much been in the hunt for points. We don't really have a team like Williams a few years ago who are cut adrift at the bottom. What we've got at the moment is probably a very, very big midfield where different teams and different drivers in different circuits and different conditions are very capable of getting into the points. You know, we saw Alex Albon scoring a point for Williams last year, last time out in Bahrain. Williams, who only got 8 points in the entire season last year. So I think, there's every reason for McLaren to be more optimistic now than they were after Bahrain. Obviously, the next race we've got is the Australian Grand Prix, Piastri's home race. And of course, he's going to be wanting to give his home fans a good performance there.
With Piastri's sort of emergence in this season, Lando Norris has been there a couple of years. Dieter, who do you think the number one driver is over at Woking? Because I can't see it at the moment. It's only been a couple of races, but who do you think the number one driver is over at McLaren?
I think it's very simple. Whoever's the quickest during the weekend deserves the team's focus. It's that simple because, ultimately what you need is two young guns really pushing each other. The minute you have a number one and a number two situation, the number one gets a bit comfortable or could get a bit comfortable, and the number two says, well, it doesn't matter what I really do, I'm still going to be overshadowed. What you really need in a race team is two guys who really push each other. It's different where you have an undisputed pecking order where, you've got a three-time world champion and then you have a sort of a rookie coming in. Then obviously, the rookie's got to learn from the wise guy. But equally, there's no reason why the rookie shouldn't push this wise guy. And, if we go back to 2007 with McLaren, for example, there was Fernando Alonso, double world champion. Lewis comes in, an absolute rookie, has never raced a Formula One car. Imagine if they'd imposed team orders then. And, this is what it's all about. We're talking about race teams. I think the critical thing is that there's always got to be on-track respect between the two drivers, regardless of whether one's been there for 3 years and the other one for three races or whatever. And above all, they need to push each other and both do their very best to deliver for the team.
And it was a bit of a horror show from Lando Norris as well. We've been talking about how well Piastri performed. Lando Norris had a bit of a weekend to forget. He struck the wall in qualifying. To be fair, he fronted up. He said that was his mistake. He shouldn't have done that. But very much a weekend to forget for Norris. Maybe one of his worst weekends since he's been in Formula One. And if McLaren are going to follow Dieter's recommendation of whichever is the fastest and the best driver on any given weekend is the number one, then Norris is going to have to perform much better than he did this weekend in Jeddah.
And that's what it's all about, frankly.
I always think that you should listen to Dieter anyway. So McLaren, if you're listening, follow Dieter's advice. We had two DNFs, Albon and Stroll. Michael, what happened with the Aston Martin man?
Well, he pulled off. It's less, really, it's less interesting about why he pulled off and more interesting the consequence of him pulling off where he did. He was told to stop the car by Aston Martin, and then he stopped the car just about as far away out of trouble as he possibly could, right next to the entrance of a service road. And yet we still saw the deployment of the full safety car, which seemed very, very unnecessary to me. He was right. He was very much off the racing line. There's a lot of runoff area at that final corner at Jeddah. He was right next to the entrance of the service road. And I think a virtual safety car would have perfectly sufficed there. I could understand maybe double waved yellows wouldn't have been enough because there would have needed to have been marshals somewhat on the course area to try to push the Aston Martin completely out of range. But I thought a full safety car was very, very excessive. And obviously then that had the knock-on effect of bunching the pack up. It didn't have a significant bearing on the result, certainly at the front. I think Perez would still have won and Verstappen would still have finished second because Red Bull had such a pace advantage. But it would have taken him a lot longer to get through. Ferrari certainly lost out a little bit here because Lewis Hamilton was able to get ahead of Carlos Sainz and of Charles Leclerc. I know that we had Paul Stoddard writing in typically forthright fashion for Racing News 365, as he's started doing for us this year, typically entertaining the former Minardi team boss. He was certainly very vocal to his opposition to that safety car deployment. And it reminds me of a little bit of Monaco last year, where we accused the FIA and the stewards of being too cautious. You know, they delayed the start there. It was damp conditions. They delayed the start by about an hour. And then we had a safety car start. And I remember, Dieter, we were talking about that at the time, wondering whether that was an instance of a little bit too much caution being displayed. And it felt to me as if you could apply a similar sort of logic here.
Absolutely, Michael. And in fact, I was going to mention that. I increasingly get the feeling that at FIA level, safety becomes the default excuse for anything. Somebody makes a mistake. There were safety considerations. Now, you know, safety is laudable. Safety is paramount. And, you know, I've had many, many conversations with the various safety officials, including the safety director at the FIA. I was in Geneva last week. I spoke to Tim Mallion, the safety director. I absolutely respect that there is this paramount need for safety, and I make no bones about that. But equally, I get the feeling that very often, if there is a human error at officiating level, let's just pull out the safety card and let's say, well, you know, it's, we had to consider safety before we could take a decision. Yeah, but equally, you know, these cars have got cameras all over the place for safety reasons. And, you know, to say that it wasn't quite clear exactly where the car was, well, there's GPS, there's all sorts of stuff. And, you know, if Checo Perez had lost the race because of that, and it's perfectly conceivable that he would have, you know, it would have been a real, real shame. And, you know, it happened last year with a safety car. He lost the race because he pitted out of sequence. And so, yeah, we have to be very, very careful. Ultimately, you know, if a referee just sort of blows the whistle at the wrong time, it can change the face of a game, a football match or whatever it is. And equally, we cannot have that in Formula One. Simple.
Yeah, the justification from the stewards was that they looked at the GPS data from Stroll's car and deduced that it was in an unsafe position. Well, millions of us watching in our armchairs, watching the TV coverage, could see that it clearly wasn't. It was right well out of the way, right next to the service road. And the virtual safety car, when it was introduced into Formula One in about 2015 or so, this seems like precisely the sort of incident that it was introduced for, because it was a reaction to what happened at the Japanese Grand Prix in 2014 with poor old Jules Bianchi, when they didn't put the safety car out. They had double waved yellows when there was the tractor on track. And the whole point of the virtual safety car is that you can neutralize the race without needing to deploy the safety car, without artificially bunching the pack up. And then obviously that can last several laps while the safety car tours around and then comes back in the pits. Whereas the VSC, you know, we can have that for even less than one lap, just over half a lap or so. And so, yeah, it felt like a really missed opportunity. And yeah, as you said, Dieter, it could have had a significant bearing on the race. Thankfully, it didn't. But yeah, again, I think they need to look at the application of the safety car, the virtual safety car, and when they should deploy each one.
Absolutely.
I should have said this at the top of the podcast, but I am a Mercedes fan, and as much as I hate to admit it, Verstappen was the driver of the day. He from 15th to 2nd. Dieter, from the paddock, what was the feeling when he was going up the pack, up to his final P2 place?
Well, I think ultimately we need to look at it against the background of that particular safety car. That eased his way through to second, without doubt. And again, I would have preferred to have seen him really have to fight through 15th to 14th to 13th, etc., all the way through to second and then to first. And who knows, without that safety car, he may actually not have finished second. He may have been third. Who knows? Because, you know, he managed with that safety car intervention, he managed to leapfrog quite a few of the cars ahead of him. So it comes back to that. But ultimately, I mean, it was an absolutely superb drive, a superb drive. But, you know, in my book, the driver of the day was actually Checo Perez. Yes, his task was made easier by the drive shaft failure on Saturday, which helped him get pole position. But let's not forget that for the opening laps, he either had Fernando breathing down his neck or, in fact, running ahead of him, hoping to lure him into a mistake. And, you know, Checo withstood all this pressure. And, you know, having Fernando behind you ain't easy. And Fernando was constantly probing for a weak spot, the sort of soft underbelly, didn't find it. And then after that, Checo had to manage the gap to Max, who, as we know, is a ferocious competitor. There was that drive shaft issue at one stage towards the end that Max was alluding to. But his car was certainly capable of taking fastest lap. So there doesn't appear to be much wrong with the car, and yet Checo managed to hold that gap at about 5 seconds. While we're talking about the fastest lap, I think that Checo has got a right to feel aggrieved about the fastest lap, because from what I understand, he was sort of led to believe that, don't worry about the fastest lap, and he thought it was his. And, you know, whereas there was Max, when he said, what about the fastest lap? He said, we're not focusing on that. He said, I am. And what I would really have liked to have seen is for Checo to have been able to be given a better shot at fastest lap. And then really let the top driver win on that one. I know that he tried, but I don't think that his mind was quite there, and I don't think that his tyres were quite there at the time. I think a bit earlier, and he could also have taken the fastest lap.
So moving on to Mercedes, I think it was a better race than Bahrain. Michael, what do you think of what happened on track in Jeddah?
You say better, Balv. I think it was less bad. I think they're still a long way from where they would want to be. George Russell, I thought, was very impressive. And P4, I think, was just about the maximum that he could have extracted from the W14, given the pace advantage that Aston Martin and that Red Bull seem to have. Hamilton finishing in fifth place, just one place behind George Russell. It does appear, just like the beginning of last year, it does appear as if George Russell maybe just has the edge on Lewis Hamilton at the moment. Maybe the W14 working a little bit better for him. We've heard Lewis Hamilton with some pretty downbeat comments at the moment, saying that he just can't get the car to work. He just doesn't seem to like it. But Mercedes still a long way off where they want to be. I thought the image in the race that really epitomised where they are versus Red Bull was when Max Verstappen was hunting down George Russell and passing him with such consummate ease with the DRS open. The DRS on the Red Bull does seem to be incredibly effective. Martin Brundle on the TV broadcast, you could hear him just go, what? Just incredulous at the closing speed that Verstappen had over George Russell. So, yeah, still not where they want to be, but certainly quicker than Ferrari. And I think that's something that we wouldn't have been expecting to have been saying after pre-season testing. It looked as if Ferrari would have been the second team behind Red Bull, and then maybe Aston Martin, and then maybe Mercedes. So Mercedes at the moment, not where they want to be, but George Russell extracting the best from a somewhat limited package at the moment.
Going from Mercedes, Michael, thank you for explaining that, on to Ferrari. Dieter, it looks like it goes from bad to worse for Sainz and Leclerc.
Well, I think we need to say for Ferrari as a scuderia, so to speak. They last year decided to remove Mattia Binotto, or rather he resigned, but I believe the pressure was put on him. So, but in any event, the bottom line is that Mattia Binotto left. Fred Vasseur came in as team principal. I'm hearing all sorts of things internally, which are really, really concerning. That I think the most important thing is that Mattia Binotto was managing director of Scuderia Ferrari as well as team principal. Fred Vasseur is general manager of Scuderia Ferrari as well as team principal. There's a massive difference between being general manager and managing director. Yeah, of course, people can say it's only semantics. Yes, it's only a job title, etc. But I do believe that being managing director proves that you have an element of authority that goes above that of the general manager, right? And I'm hearing all sorts of things, stories about interference from the chairman, John Elkann, the CEO of Ferrari, Benedetto Vigna, who doesn't even come from the motor industry, doesn't have any form of motorsport background. The closest that he's ever come to motorsport is he ran a company that produced chips for some of your computer video games, etc., including Formula One type games. But that's the closest he's ever come to this. Now, people can turn around and say, well, you know, do you really have to be a dyed-in-the-wool Formula One man to run a race team? No, but you do need to understand the nuances of things like strategies of tire degradation, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, I'm extremely, extremely concerned that there is this this interference from up above where everybody seems to believe they know better. And, you know, I frankly fear for the Scuderia. You know, people think Ferrari's Ferrari, they'll always be there. Well, we said this about Lotus. We said it about Brabham. We said it about Cooper in the past. We said it about all sorts of hallowed Formula One names. And frankly, I am concerned that we could get to a stage where the Scuderia implodes totally. And that's not good for Ferrari, not good for the thousands of employees, and not good for Formula One. I really believe they've now got to let Fred Vasseur get on with running it. And if they believe he can't do it, get somebody else. But don't constantly interrupt. And this is what I'm hearing is happening all the time in Maranello, and it's extremely concerning. If we have a look at the successful business models, you know, Mercedes is at the moment not successful, but we don't have, or I believe we don't have, any interruption from the CEO of Mercedes above Toto Wolff say, I do this, change your tires then. Why did you take this tire choice, etc.? We see it with other race teams. You know, McLaren is part of a conglomerate. They're also not performing at the moment, but we don't have the top guys interfering. And if what I'm hearing is true, that there is this this constant interruption and interference, I'm extremely concerned for the future of Ferrari.
Dieter, Michael, thank you so much for looking after me on my first podcast on Racing News at 365.com. I think I've come out of it unscathed and I'm still alive. So no race this weekend. So we'll be back in a week's time previewing the Australian Grand Prix. We'll see you then.